Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Jeremy Holden of Media Matters for America, who discusses his group's study that concludes that U.S. Network TV News misleads the public on Iran's nuclear threat. Dolores Huerta, co-founder of the United Farm Workers Union, who reminds progressive activists that together they have the power to advance social justice in America. And BBC TV investigative journalist Greg Palast, who reveals that British Petroleum covered up a 2008 oil rig blowout in the Caspian Sea, similar to the blowout which led to the company's disastrous Gulf of Mexico oil spill in 2010. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Riot police patrolled the streets of Bahrain's capital city of Manama as tourists attended the April 22nd Formula One car race, an event that this nation's monarchy hoped would convey the impression that this country of 1.25 million in the Persian Gulf was returning to normal. Bahrain is home base to the U.S. Navy's Fifth Fleet. On the eve of the Grand Prix race, over 100,000 opposition activists, mostly Shia, marched against the Formula One race organized by Crown Prince Salman bin Hamad Al Khalifa. Police fired tear gas against 100 protesters who tried to enter the Pearl Roundabout, the scene of last spring's democracy uprising that was crushed with the aid of troops from Saudi Arabia and other Gulf countries. Since the uprising was repressed, over 50 opposition activists have been killed, and over 4,000 people lost their jobs. Jailed Shia activist Abdullah Hadi al-Khawaja has been on a hunger strike for over 70 days and is in poor health. In the weeks leading to the Formula One race, opposition activists, mostly part of the nation's Shia majority, held regular protests in poor villages and complained of police firing birdshot and rounding up activists during night raids. Despite promised reforms by the Sunni monarchy, an estimated 400 political prisoners remain in jail. Pro-Sunni groups like the Gathering for National Unity reject any concessions to Shia protesters that they blame for creating violence in the streets. The Vatican has moved to reassert control over the largest body of American Catholic nuns, the Leadership Council of Women Religious, which represents 80% of U.S. Catholic sisters. The Vatican appointed Seattle Bishop Peter Sartain to oversee the group for 5 years, with the task of revising its mission, structure, and programs. The Women's Association has been under review since 2008 over concerns Catholic nuns spend too much time on social justice issues and neglected the Vatican's stance on human sexuality, including opposition to abortion and homosexuality. The 8-page document released by the Vatican blasts the Women's Federation for having strong ties with two groups: Network, a Catholic-based social justice lobby that supported the Obama health care reform, and the Resource Center for Religious Life. The Vatican documents also question Catholic sisters for their silence on issues like birth control. Sister Simone Campbell, director of Network, insisted it was her group's work on health care in opposition to the U.S. Catholic bishops which prompted the Vatican to act. The recent moves to enforce Catholic orthodoxy contrast with the traditions of Catholic sisters in the United States who proclaim community service as a calling. Many nuns take a vow of poverty to engage in charitable work, including running schools, hospitals, and social service agencies that aid the poor. As an increasing number of America's traditional daily newspapers lay off reporters and close down, major private foundations have stepped forward to fund new nonprofit journalistic institutions to deliver timely information and analysis. Yet the Internal Revenue Service has moved very slowly to grant 501c3 nonprofit status to not-for-profit news organizations. Some of these news groups have waited up to 2 years to win 501c3 status, the key to winning foundation grants. The delay has caused some of the new news organizations to lay off staff, consolidate, or shut down. Part of the problem is that many news directors looking to make the transition do not understand the legal terminology required to establish a nonprofit, including defining themselves as an educational institution as opposed to a media outlet. An example of the lengthy process can be seen in the time it took the IRS to review the 501c3 application of the Investigative News Network, a consortium of 60 nonprofit news groups which works jointly on news stories, shares administrative costs, and promotes investigative reporting. The group received its IRS approval letter in mid-March after a 19-month wait. A growing number of people in the news industry have come around to the idea that the nonprofit model is ideal for engaging in in-depth investigative reporting. In working for an educational nonprofit, journalists fill the role of researcher and experts who develop specialized skills in topics like healthcare, campaign finance, and the environment. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Zelfia Hunter.
In the months before the Bush administration launched its invasion of Iraq in 2003, many of the most influential media outlets in the U.S. had worked closely with White House officials to bolster the administration's case for war. The allegation that Saddam Hussein's government had a stockpile of deadly weapons of mass destruction, including a nuclear program, served as the major rationale for selling the war to the American public. Well-known reporters like the New York Times' Judith Miller were prominently featured verifying the danger posed by Iraq to America in the post-9/11 era. Years after the war began, with no weapons of mass destruction having been found, several major news outlets, including the New York Times, confessed to sloppy reporting and flawed coverage, which had misled many to support the disastrous and costly conflict. Now, as there's open discussion about U.S. or Israeli preemptive airstrikes targeting Iran, relating to allegations that the Iranian government is working to build nuclear weapons capability, the role of the U.S. news media is being scrutinized. The group Media Matters for America recently completed a 5-month study of how America's three major television networks are covering the debate over Iran's nuclear program, which the Islamic Republic maintains is for civilian energy purposes only. The study found that ABC's World News, CBS's Evening News, and NBC's Nightly News all regularly and inaccurately reported that Iran was imminently on the cusp of building a nuclear weapon. The study also concluded that the networks misrepresented the role of Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad in directing his nation's nuclear program. Your reporter spoke with Jeremy Holden, research director with the group Media Matters for America, who summarizes his group's finding that U.S. network TV news distorts their coverage of Iran's nuclear capacity.
Two of the things that we looked at were how they portrayed suspicions that Iran is pursuing a nuclear weapons program. Now, from the outset, it's important to point out that the consensus of the international community, but like international agencies, Israeli intelligence, U.S. intelligence, is that Iran is at least 3 years away from having a really usable nuclear weapon. And that's if there was evidence that they had restarted something. The intelligence agencies tell us that there's no evidence that Iran has restarted a nuclear weapons program at any time since 2003. So that's what we know. But in the meantime, what we're seeing on the nightly news broadcast is this notion that a nuclear weapons program in Iran is imminent. And this flies in the face of what we see from the intelligence communities. That's number one. The second thing we see is this heightened focus on the president of Iran, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, despite the fact that he is, for all intents and purposes, a paper tiger. He has no real power in the country. That power resides with the supreme leader. Mahmoud Ahmadinejad is a very colorful figure. He said some very outlandish and frankly outrageous things that have no role in the international community. But by focusing on him, it really creates this fear, this notion that he has power or any control. It's a complete distortion of the reality of how Iran works as a political system.
Jeremy, summarize for our listeners what your investigation revealed about specific content that we get in our nightly newscasts that really mislead viewers about the status of Iran's nuclear program.
So one of the big things that's happened recently was the International Atomic Energy Agency came out with a new report, showing that really nothing has changed. Or, Iran, if we learned that they had restarted a program, again, no evidence of that, but if we were to learn that they started again, they would be 3 years away. So what you see is Diane Sawyer on ABC News coming out and saying that we have a long dreaded headline about Iran and nuclear weapons, that the UN report says they will and it has begun this nuclear weapons program. Well, that's not what the report actually said. So you have these inflammatory headlines being read at the top of the news, and again, that kind of fits into what we've heard over and over and over again, but the facts of what we know the actual consensus of the international community is completely contradictory to that. And about 31% of the stories on Iran's nuclear program, the issue was portrayed as like an imminent threat, that nuclear weapons in Iran were just around the corner. And in about one in five cases, the news reports really focused on Ahmadinejad and portrayed him as the key player. And again, we have this notion of his statements about wiping Israel off the map and not any of his other statements. So, you're seeing in kind of a plurality of the cases, Ahmadinejad, an imminent weapons program, and we know that the strength of Ahmadinejad and the imminence of that weapons program are contrary to the facts as we actually know them.
That was Jeremy Holden, research director with the group Media Matters for America. Find more information on the group's media study related to Iran on our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Dolores Huerta, co-founder with Cesar Chavez of the United Farm Workers Union and a lifelong social justice activist, was the keynote speaker at the 20th Annual Conference of Southern Connecticut State University's Women's Studies Program on April 21st. Huerta began her career as a community organizer in 1955. In 1965, she directed the United Farm Workers' national boycott of table grapes, which resulted in winning union contracts with the grape industry. She was a strong supporter of Robert F. Kennedy's run for president in 1968 and was standing next to him on June 5th as he delivered a victory speech shortly after winning the California Democratic presidential primary. He was assassinated 15 minutes later. In 2002, she founded the Dolores Huerta Foundation, which provides grants for community organizing. In 1988, Huerta was severely beaten by a San Francisco police officer, and after suing the department, won a monthly $2,000 payment for life. Huerta, who's now 82 years old and was battling a cold, stood at the podium at the Women's Studies Conference for 45 minutes and spoke forcefully about the need for everyone seeking social change to become an activist, as she called for breaking down the silos dividing the progressive movement. She began her comments by announcing that she had 11 children and she didn't need the Catholic Church to tell her how to live her life. The following is an excerpt from her talk.
We're not going to be able to win unless all of our movements come together. Right now, we've got everybody kind of working on their own little silo, right? We've got the women's movement over here, the labor movement over here, the immigrant rights movement over here, the civil rights movement over here, LGBT movements way over here. But so if we all can all come together, I think that ultimately that's the only way that we're going to be able to win. I think we have a window of opportunity come November in this election. One thing about those Tea Party people, we can say, okay, they're a little loony, whatever, but the thing is that they're organized, right? They're organized, and they send those letters, those emails, they're in people's faces, and we've got to do the same thing. We are the majority. Back in 2006, there were 2 million immigrants marching. Not just immigrants, I'm sure some of you were in those marches on the street also. That was the largest march ever in the United States of America on one issue. The largest march ever. When we had the Women's March on Washington, how many of you were on that march, the Women's March on Washington? See some hands here? Okay, that was the largest march on Washington ever. Did you know that? So if we can get all of our groups together, the labor groups, the immigrant rights groups, then we actually can make the difference in our country. And we don't have too much of an opportunity to change that. I think this is our big opportunity, because if we don't, I think we're going to have the forces of evil, so we call it that, are going to come back in there even stronger than they were before. And they're going to continue the corporatization of our country and that kind of control that we've seen that has wrought so much damage to our United States of America. And we know that we can change it, but it's in our hands. You know, I always tell people the story when Cesar Chavez and I started organizing farm workers, and people would say to us, how are you going to organize farm workers? They're poor, they don't speak English, they're not citizens, they don't have any assets. How can you possibly get those people to organize? Well, the way we did it is that we met with farm workers in their homes, almost, you know, family by family, and what we said to the farm workers is, you have power. And they would say, well, where's our power? Well, the power is in your person, right? The power is in your person. But we know that we really can't do anything, or you can't do anything, unless you come together with other farm workers. And you've got to take direct action. And you've got to take responsibility, because the one thing that we have to really understand is that nobody will change anything for us. We are the only ones that can change it. We have to take that responsibility. Once the farm workers understood that, then they would go on strike, and they would go on marches, and they would register people to vote, and they'd get people out to vote, go to Sacramento, come to Washington, go to New York, you know, do all that work that they did on the boycott. I remember one story when I was in New York on the boycott, and this farm worker called me, and we were asking people not to eat grapes, don't shop at the stores that have grapes. And this one farm worker called me, he said, Señora Dolores, he said, ya quitaron la uva, he said, Señora Huerta, he said, they took off the grapes off the store. And so I said to this farm worker, well, what's the name of the store? This is downtown Manhattan, right? And he said, I don't know. I said, well, look at the sign. And then he said, Señora, I don't know how to read. I don't know how to read. And I remember when he said that, it kind of brought tears to my eyes, because I thought that's what they were. They were farm workers that went out there and they did that kind of work. So here we are. Most of us have a formal education, right? And so we could do so much more work. And we've got to make that commitment that we just got to go out there and we've got to be activists and we've got to make that happen. We've got to make those changes. Again, because we know if we don't do it, nobody else is going to do it for us. And we used to tell the farm workers a little story, and I'm going to share that with you. This was one of the stories that Caesar came up with. And the story was that there was this horseman. We call him in Spanish a jinete, like a cowboy, right? And he's a pretty macho guy. He's riding on his horse, and he's got a big old whip. And he sees a little dog, and he hits the dog with his whip. The dog goes barking, running away. And so he feels pretty macho, so he's going down, and then he sees a cow. He lifts his whip up, and he hits the cow with the whip. The cow goes moo, moo, mooing, running away. So he keeps riding, and then he sees this tree. And he raises his whip, and he twirls his whip, and he looks up. He sees a nest of bees up there, a beehive, and then he says, I better not, they're organized. so that has got to be us, okay? We've got to become so organized that they will not dare, you know, hit us with those lashes, with those whips, and trying to wrap those whips around our neck and then drag us back into the last century.
That was Dolores Huerta, speaking at the 20th Annual Women's Studies Conference at Southern Connecticut State University on April 21st. She is the author of The Dolores Huerta Reader, featuring articles about the impact the lifelong activist has had on the labor, women's, and immigrant rights movements. This segment was recorded and produced by Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus. Find links to more information about Dolores Huerta's activist career on our Between the Lines website, at btlonline.org. It's been 2 years since a blowout and explosion on British Petroleum's Deepwater Horizon oil rig in the Gulf of Mexico led to the deaths of 11 crew members and the worst oil spill in U.S. history. Although much of the oil that washed ashore along 600 miles of Gulf shoreline is no longer visible, the long-term damage from the uncontrolled spill of 4.9 million barrels of oil over 3 months is unknown. It may take decades for researchers and scientists to understand the full impact of the oil spill on human health and the Gulf's marine life and ecosystem. But despite the unknowns, attorneys representing British Petroleum and over 100,000 plaintiffs announced a settlement that the company estimates will total about $7.8 billion, which constitutes one of the largest class action settlements in U.S. history. The settlement agreement could delay a trial involving BP, the rig's owner Transocean, and Halliburton, the company responsible for cementing the well. The U.S. Justice Department recently filed its first criminal charge in the disaster, accusing a former BP engineer of destroying evidence in the case. In an announcement coinciding with the second anniversary of the 2010 oil spill disaster, BBC TV investigative journalist and author Greg Palast revealed that in September 2008, another oil rig owned by BP in the Caspian Sea had undergone a blowout similar to that suffered by the Deepwater Horizon, but the incident was covered up by the oil company and the Bush administration. Your reporter spoke with Palast, who explains how he discovered the earlier BP blowout and why covering up the incident led to the later Gulf of Mexico disaster.
The Deepwater Horizon blowout 2 years ago Friday, April 20, was not BP's first big blowout. Right after it happened, I get a cable from an eyewitness floating in the Caspian Sea who says, this ain't the first blowout. Actually, I had to get to a secure line first, get that information. BP's big giant rig in the Caspian Sea also blew out 2 years earlier, 2008. BP covered it up. What's even worse is clearly the same cause was at the bottom of it, the use of a money-saving cement formula called quick-dry cement. You mix nitrogen into the cement, you make it like a milkshake. It dries quicker, and that saves tons of money, millions on rig rentals, easier to handle, except, like, you know, if you end up with an explosion, you end up with a blowout. So we did have a blowout. So this is a very serious accusation because that makes the Deepwater Horizon not an accident, but a negligent homicide. So I had to fly to the Caspian Sea for Channel 4 Television Britain, and I found two more witnesses who worked on the rig that had blown out and evacuated, saved their lives. But I was arrested because BP got tipped off, which told the government. I was arrested by BP and the government together, and the witnesses disappeared. And I still got some of the film because I had one of those little Austin Power camera and pen jobs, but still I needed more evidence. And from The Guardian, I got the WikiLeaks cables. The U.S. Embassy in Azerbaijan got all the information from BP's president in the Caspian Sea, who said, yes, giant blowout, biggest evacuation in BP history at that time, cement, mud all over the place. Lucky that the whole thing didn't cost 200 lives. And BP then covered it up. The State Department helped them cover it up. In fact, the State Department only demanded the truth from BP because Chevron wanted the information. Chevron was a junior partner and wanted to know why it wasn't getting its, you know, like $100 million a day from that field because the Caspian Sea rig had blown out. And so Chevron knew, Exxon knew, another partner, BP knew, the Azerbaijan government, which is basically another subsidiary of BP, the U.S. State Department knew, but we didn't know, our regulators didn't know, you know, so it was all covered up. And as a result, they didn't change their methods. They used the same cement. They made several of the same mistakes as in the Caspian Sea. They did in the Gulf, and we lost 11 guys and had, obviously, a horrific spill.
Greg, some of the witnesses that came forward to talk to you had disappeared not long after the arrest of your camera crew there for BBC TV. Do you know the fate of those witnesses?
I wish I did. There were three witnesses. I can tell you that one got out of the country safe. I can tell you that two, we have no idea what happened to them. And this is one of the reasons why people don't come forward. As one witness said, people disappear in Azerbaijan. If you wonder where Azerbaijan is, it's capitalist Baku. It's the first place that they ever sold oil from. For 1,000 years, they've been selling oil there. They've been drilling for oil. And it is controlled by a dictatorship installed by British Petroleum. There was an elected president when the nation was created out of the Soviet Union in 1991, but he wouldn't give BP a drilling contract for their massive Caspian Sea reserves. So involving MI6, the CIA, and British Petroleum, there was support for coup d'etat by the former KGB chief, and his family is still in charge there to today.
Greg, is it against the law to conceal in the way British Petroleum did the oil rig blowout and the faulty nitrogen-laden pick-dry cement, as you call it, that did not work to prevent a huge methane blowout there in the Caspian Sea?
Well, I would say yes, having been an investigator, but I also took the information to Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who is a dean of environmental law at the law school here in New York, and he's also the senior attorney for the National Resources Defense Council and for EcoWatch. So he really knows his stuff on this. I've been in many racketeering cases, and we agree. This type of concealment is criminal. And I could say for certain that you have a massive, massive civil violation here. But it probably constitutes criminal negligence. And I do know that there's one other thing that they did that is straight up against the law. That is BP withheld the information from the U.S. Securities Exchange Commission. They did file a report because that explained why they weren't getting all this money from the Caspian that they were used to getting. They lost hundreds of millions of dollars in oil. But BP basically made up some cockamamie story to the Securities Exchange Commission about what happened to that rig. And you can't lie to the Securities Exchange Commission. That's serious business. That's stockholders, and they really get angry. So you have violation of SEC rules, violation of British rules about informing the other contractors. You have the general rule of torts in America about concealment, and BP, Chevron, and Exxon told Congress that they drilled safely for 50 years. Clearly, they had excluded crucial information about the 2008 blowout. Just so you know, Bobby Kennedy and I will be preparing this material to demand that Eric Holder, the Attorney General of the United States, investigate BP, Chevron, Exxon, and the Bush State Department for concealing this information. At least have a civil trial so we can put them on the stand, ask these questions under oath.
That was BBC TV investigative reporter Greg Palast. He's the author of Vulture's Picnic, Our Madhouse, and the Best Democracy Money Can Buy. Find links to Palast's investigations on our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by writing us at mail@btlonline.org. Visit our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Hank Hoffman, Zelfia Hunter, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.